This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
But if we were to cover it with solar cells and cover the world's deserts with solar cells, it would destroy civilization as we know it within a single generation.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My original goal for this Radio EcoShock series on alternative energy was to find the most reasonable critic of green energy who was not directly a beneficiary of competing energy sources, that is, a person with academic credentials who is not receiving money or other benefits from the coal, oil, or gas industries. California author and green energy expert Ozzie Zehner certainly fits that bill. His book Green Illusions is worth reading. I ran Ozzie's speech at Google last week on the show. If you missed that, download it from our website at ecoshock.org or listen to it on our SoundCloud page. Then I hope to hold a second program where I ask for listener questions and pose them to Ozzie in an extended interview. Ozzie replied he is willing to come on Radio EcoShock, but could not appear until next summer due to a project he's presently working on. So we can't hear from Ozzie right now, but I hope we can pick this up again later in the season if we need to. Ozzie applies his years of study, his European experience in energy, and his keen intellect to persuade us alternative energy like wind and solar are not really green. They cannot power our civilization without heavy fossil fuel inputs. They damage the environment, from cutting down trees to toxic byproducts. We should put our focus and money, he says, into indirect methods of cutting carbon dioxide emissions by creating a better society. In particular, Ozzie suggests population control via a fair healthcare system could be coupled with conservation, urban densification, and other energy-saving techniques to reduce carbon emissions. Ozzie Zehner makes some statements that raise serious questions. For example, he says increasing the current low amount of solar energy in the United States would bankrupt the American government. I thought the U.S. government was already bankrupt, and not because of solar subsidies. Going even further with solar to power our world, Ozzie claims could destroy civilization within a generation. Later in this program, I'll check on some of the claims made in Ozzie's presentation and suggest other possibilities. Hang in for that. But first, we'll have a conversation with clean energy tech guru Dan Miller.
Radio EcoShock.
We can't let Ozzie Zehner tell us not to hope for solar or wind power without getting another opinion at least. Maybe the green patient isn't so dead after all. Now, I've got Dan Miller on the line. He's the managing director of The Rota Group, a Berkeley venture capital group that he co-founded, and it's focused on clean tech. He's involved with the technology to capture carbon. He has a history in the telecommunications and aerospace industries. Dan is passionate about solving climate change, as you can hear in his TEDx talk on YouTube. That's where I first met him, and also through email. So, Dan Miller, a hearty welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here.
So, why don't we first of all get a little bit of an introduction to who you are and where you're coming from? Can you tell us what you do?
Okay, well, the Rota Group is, as you mentioned, a venture capital group that invests in seed stage or early stage companies involved with technologies that can help address climate change and the depletion of natural resources. Just a quick overview of some of the companies in our portfolio today includes a company that can capture CO2 from power plants for a very low cost and using very little energy, something that's up till now not really been available. Another company working on a really neat lead-acid battery that has low cost, like a lead-acid battery, but has the performance of a lithium-ion battery in terms of rechargeability, and that opens up the market for low-cost energy storage for things like storing energy from your solar panels at home. You can use lead-acid batteries. They don't work too well in that situation, or you can use a lithium-ion, but that's very, very expensive. So this is trying to bridge those two together. Another company that helps farmers grow more food with less water, and one other company that helps clean toxic organics from industrial wastewater. So those are the kinds of things that we're involved in. And in addition to what I call my day job, I do give talks on climate change and the policy solutions that can help lead us out of the wilderness.
Yeah, batteries is part of the problem, storing this renewable energy. And it's something that Ozzie Zehner brings up. It's something I've wondered about, and I've got two rather bizarre ideas about it I want to run by you. One is, first of all, we need more tools that will work directly off 12-volt power without the intermediary of a battery. So if I have a power drill or something and I've got a solar panel going, I don't need to store it. I can just use it right there. Can we do that? Have you heard about that?
Well, there, of course. I mean, just take anything that runs off on a boat, right? A boat is DC power, and there's lighting, there's all kinds of things. But it's not that critical an issue because you can always get what's called an inverter.
Well, I guess my question is, why can't we run things directly off the solar power without having the battery at all as an intermediary? I mean, you talked about having a boat and you run everything off, say, the solar panel. But in fact, there is a battery in that circuit. And if you take the battery out, maybe you can't use your tools.
That's right. Well, actually, yeah, solar panels do require some amount of energy storage to sort of smooth out the voltage. Because, you know, as the clouds go by and the shading and things like that, the voltage is going to fluctuate and the current is going to fluctuate quite a bit. So by charging, either by putting it directly into the grid, which has a lot of other current and available, so it sort of smooths out itself, or if you're at home off the grid, then you need some amount of storage. So the solar panels charge a battery system, and then that battery system can give you constant voltage and current output so you can, you know, run things, run your lights and your tools and things like that. Right now, as I was saying, the lead-acid batteries can do that, but they don't perform well when you charge and discharge them a lot. Lithium ions do perform well in that situation, but are very expensive. Our company is trying to sort of bridge those two by making a low-cost lead-acid battery that has the rechargeability performance of a lithium-ion battery. And so as energy storage prices drop, then it'll be easier to go off the grid and it'll be easier to use renewable energy and these kinds of things. So it's an important technology.
And the other suggestion that I have for our civilization trying to keep going on renewables would be to accept that sometimes power is intermittent, that we try and schedule things for the daylight when there is some solar power, we hope, and to make factories run when wind power is strong, rather than always presuming we can have all the power we want all the time at any time. All right, now you've had a chance to listen to the Google talk given by Ozzy Zehner, Green Illusions, that he's saying solar and wind power and other renewables are really an extension of this fossil-powered civilization. And without all the fossil power necessary, I guess the trucks to mine the metals for the batteries and so on, you really couldn't have renewables. Now, I wanted to get your impressions after watching that Google talk.
Well, I thought, yeah, he's kind of complaining about things without providing any solutions. So right now we use fossil fuels to, you know, power our computers and, you know, heat our house and whatever. And when we're done with that, we need more energy after that, and yet there's more and more CO2 put in the air. With renewable energy systems, you do need to use some fossil fuels to start building them, right? But once you have them, they generate energy without emitting greenhouse gases. So that's a really good thing. And I think what he's trying to argue is that if you take a look at the fossil fuel impact of a solar panel, and then you multiply by all the solar panels we'll ever need to replace all the fossil fuels, you end up emitting too much carbon. Well, if you do that calculation, maybe that's right, but that's not really what happens, of course. Once you start building renewable energy systems, you start using renewable energy to make the next set of renewable energy systems. So, for example, let's say we've finally switched to half renewable energy. Well, then the new renewable energy systems we build, solar panels, solar thermal, wind systems, will be built using renewable energy. So that's the path we need to get on. So if you look at fossil fuel emissions as some finite resource, and it really better be a finite resource, then the best place to dedicate those emissions is to building renewable energy systems so that we get off of this track that we're on of only burning fossil fuels. So I think his basic premise is just basically wrong. He's assuming sort of the worst case from the beginning, and he's assuming that even when you've switched over to renewable energy, you're still not using renewable energy. It doesn't really make any sense. He's also, I think, just wrong about his facts. There was a recent Stanford study to show that solar panels pay back all of the emissions used to make them in 1 to 4 years. And I think it's getting better now because solar power manufacturing plants are starting to use solar panels to generate energy for their manufacturer. So it's not even right, I think, even his premises. But if you extend out what he's trying to say, it just doesn't make sense. We need to switch to renewable or low-carbon energy systems so that we can generate energy in the future without causing more global warming.
And I've heard about a Spanish car factory. This was a few years ago, opened up with solar power to supplement or even produce all of the power they needed to make cars. Are we at a point or approaching a point where we can make solar panels from solar energy?
Yeah, I think they're doing that in China more and more, by the way. You know, China is, for all of the problems, China using lots of coal power, they're also the leader by far in the manufacture of solar panels, and they're planning on deploying, I heard some statistic, like more solar panels next year than all of Europe uses or something like that, or all of Denmark, I guess maybe it was, but all of just in 1 year. So that's happening today. That is happening today. And there are companies like Apple and Google are trying to run their data centers off 100% of renewable energy. And it's not just solar. It's wind. It's hydro. There's a lot of, you know, sources you can get. And as I mentioned, the company that we're working with is working on a way to capture CO2 from power plants so that you could even have a fossil fuel power plant, but you capture the CO2 before it goes in the atmosphere and you stick it back underground. So when that's deployed, there'll be even more options available.
Yeah, it's hard to picture how this future could work. One of the things that Zahner mentions is the whole mining operations. We're going to use metals for our solar panels, and we're going to use copper wiring and all that sort of thing. So I thought I'd look into that, and I looked into the mining, and it turns out that some mines are in remote sites. Most of them use diesel power, but not all of them, and especially in South Africa, they're starting to use more and more renewable energy for mining. And I think even the mining trucks can run off electricity. We can have electric mining trucks. So it doesn't all have to be diesel power if we could get our brains around this.
Well, that's the fallacy of his argument. He's taking a current situation, and you know, mining does use lots of fossil energy now, and he says, assuming that mining continues to use fossil energy forever, then the things built from the mined material will always be bad. Well, okay, but there's no reason you need to continue using fossil energy going forward. And as the world becomes more and more concerned about global warming, there will be a continued shift. And for example, one of the simplest solutions to fossil fuel emissions is to put a rising price on the carbon content of fossil fuels. And once that's done and the price gets up high enough, everyone, including mining operators, coal plant operators, and you and me, will all have incentives to use less fossil fuels or to find alternatives to fossil fuels. And so those incentives will change the playing field and will change the premise of Ozzie's arguments. I mean, that all the, quote, good things, the renewable energy systems that we build are built out of, quote, bad things, you know, mined materials and using fossil fuel energy. There's no reason why in the future renewable energy systems couldn't be built using renewable energy and materials mined using renewable energy.
I remember going to a lecture by a university professor in Vancouver called Transport Revolution, and he was making the argument that the beauty of electric-powered vehicles, for all their problems, is that anything can provide that electric power. It could be a fossil fuel that generated it in the first place. It could be nuclear power. It could be a power dam. But whatever it is, the electric power can do wonders. And even those big mining trucks, we're sort of in awe of what fossil power can do. And we think, well, only a great big diesel motor can provide that power. But it turns out electric motors are incredibly powerful, and we can get that electricity from renewable sources.
That's right. And I would say, you know, from a consumer's point of view, an electric vehicle is better than a gas-powered vehicle in every single way except for initial cost, of course, which is coming down, and the range, which is also going up. So, and both of those are getting better. But an electric car performs much better than a gas-powered car. It has, you know, incredible torque even at zero RPM. It's much more reliable because there's far fewer moving parts and subsystems. It's safer. There was a lot of press about the two Tesla fires in the United States recently. But there's 150,000 gas car fires every year in the United States. So it's safer, it performs better, it much less costly to run, far less expensive than using gas, and all these other advantages. But from a society point of view, there's a big advantage to electric vehicles. And that gets to what you were saying. If we have all gas-powered cars, to switch them to renewables is very difficult. You might have to modify each and every car. But if you have electric vehicles, you only need to improve the electric generation system. So going from coal power to wind power, for example. By that switch alone, in just a few big plants, all the cars in that region all of a sudden are running off of renewable energy. So electric cars are better for the consumer, but they're also better for society because it allows us to green the transportation fleet by changing the sources of the electric generation, as you were saying. Now, Anazi argues that, well, there are better systems like taking trains and buses and things. Well, that's all true. But, we need to address global warming right now. And even though it would be great in the future if we have denser urban populations and more public transportation, that's all great. But we also have to deal with the situation we have today.
I think, though, too, and some Greens really feel this deeply, that we can't promise people that we'll have the same life that we have now all on renewables, that we can't picture ourselves all driving down to the corner store for a bottle of pop on an electric vehicle, that everything's going to stay the same. We'll just put up a lot of solar panels and wind machines. Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think if you ask people 7 or 8 years ago, can they imagine walking around with a supercomputer in their hand, what we now call a smartphone, you could talk to and would find any information you want, it would be hard for them to imagine. I think the same is true of, for example, electric vehicles. I think, I have an electric vehicle. I think it's fantastic, and anyone who drives it will think the same thing and want to get one next. So I think we're sort of, electric vehicles are sort of the iPhones of transportation in the sense that, once you see it, once you know it, then you say, okay, I want to have that, and everybody wants to have one. So we're moving in that direction. I think it is hard for people to imagine it, but really we're not addicted to fossil fuels. We're addicted to energy. So I don't think people really care about where the electrons that are coming out of their wall outlet came from. If it's wind or solar or hydro or even nuclear, by the way, I know it's something that you're concerned about. If they're carbon free, it still powers your computer and your refrigerator and all those other things. So I think that's why we need to make this switch. There's sort of two ways to approach global warming. One is to try to tell people to use less and less and less. And I don't think that works for a number of reasons. One, if I use less fossil fuels, I'm going to help make fossil fuels a little cheaper. So someone somewhere else is going to use more of them, right? So that doesn't really address the problem. Plus, trying to convince society to, go live in a cave is just not going to work. But that's not, I think, the solution. The solution is to put a price on the bad thing. And I don't know if you've talked before about what's called the fee and dividend policy, but something that I advocate for. It's where you put a rising price on the carbon content of fossil fuels, and the fossil fuel companies pay that fee at the well, mine, or port of entry. So there's very few places you need to collect the money. And the fee starts out small, about $10 a ton of CO2, which translates to about 10 cents on a gallon of gasoline. But it rises $10 every year for the next 10 years, so it gets up to $100 eventually. And then you take all of the money collected, every single penny, and you give it back to every legal resident on an equal basis. And because wealthy people use far more CO2 than the average person, and because the government uses a large share of the CO2, and they don't get a dividend, it turns out most people are going to make more money on the dividend check they get than they pay in higher prices. So people will really like this system. And it's an economic analysis shows it will reduce emissions by over 50% in 20 years, and in the United States, create 2.8 million jobs and increase the GDP by $1.4 trillion. So there's really what's not to love. It's a system that will help us reduce emissions, and actually, rather than going to live in a cave, it'll actually help you.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. My guest is clean tech investor Dan Miller. Well, that's the system that Dr. James Hansen is pushing, and it does seem to make the most sense, not that sense always makes it through Congress or any other type of government. I think, though, Dan, that now is the time to really put that into place, because people were used to paying more at the pump. Suddenly, the price of oil has come down, and I've heard that more people are buying SUVs. We could fall back into our bad ways now that carbon is cheaper. But if we could get this little tax started and people get their checks coming, maybe we could make it out of this mess.
That's right. And actually, you live in British Columbia, I think, right? And
yep.
So that's one place where we have a similar, it's not exactly the same tax, but they do have a price on carbon that's used to help reduce taxes, which is an indirect way. I think it's much better to give people the checks directly so they can see what's happening. And we also in the United States have something called the Alaska Permanent Fund, where they take, it's not for the same reason, but they're taking some of the share of the oil drilling profits or fees that the state collects and gives it back to every citizen in Alaska. And I think every citizen got something like $1,800 this year. And people love that system, right? They're not doing it for climate reasons, but politically it's a fantastic system. Conservatives like Sarah Palin support it. So there are examples where things similar to fee and dividend exist, and they work really well, and people like them, and that's a very important part of this whole thing. So now you can also say, okay, sounds great. I love it. Boy, everyone would love it, but there's no chance, at least in the United States and our Congress, that anything's ever going to pass like that. But I would also say if you told anyone 5 years ago that the federal government in the United States would legalize gay marriage, they would think you were crazy. And what happened with that and what will happen with policies to address climate change is we're going to go from impossible to inevitable without ever passing through probable, is the expression. And it's going to just flip one day. But the question is, when will that happen? I'm quite confident it'll happen within the next 10 years, but that's too late. So we need to help it happen really in the next few years. And again, it will look like it's never going to happen, and then one day it's just going to happen. And what's going to happen is, enough conservatives will realize that they're on the wrong side of history, they're on the wrong side of science, they have children, these kinds of things. And then a few of them will come to their senses and go along with reality and what the science tells us, and then a lot of others will follow right after that. So we need to help that happen by making sure that everyone is not silent on this issue, that you talk to your family, friends, colleagues, and certainly your elected leaders, and you tell them about how important this issue is to you and to get through the misinformation that's out there. And if we all do it, actually, we can make it happen much faster.
Well, you're right. Some things that we thought were not possible, like marijuana legalization, appear to be coming along anyway. It's already happened in a couple of states. I never thought I'd live to see it. So getting back to Ozzy Zehner, I mean, he makes some pretty rational, convincing-sounding arguments. He advised his client not to buy solar panels because they really weren't all that green. And I'm worried that my listeners might come to the same conclusion. What can we say about that?
Well, first of all, I think he's just wrong. even today, as I mentioned, there's a recent study. Sally Benson was one of the authors. I don't remember the other author taking a look at the payback periods for solar panels. And this is payback from a climate sense, not from an economic sense. And it was 1 to 4 years. So and panels last for 20 to 25 years. So right off the bat, you're saying that somewhere maybe 5 to 20% of the energy generated by the solar panel over its life went to its manufacturer. But that's today. Again, as we move forward with more and more renewable energy, then the renewable energy will be used to make the renewable energy systems. And therefore, the payback will be something like 3 months rather than a year to four. So he's just wrong about that. I mean, he's taking these worst-case assumptions and he's mapping them into the future, and it's not the right way to look at the problem.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Germany and Denmark. You mentioned Denmark. I mean, they're getting a huge portion of their electricity from wind power now. It's going to be hard to tell the Danes that, well, actually, your wind machines are just extensions of the fossil fuel industry. I don't think they're going to believe you. And Germany, for a while, they had a few days this year, I think it's kind of a record, where they ran their entire economy on renewable energy for a few days. Didn't need their gas power plants, didn't need their nuclear power plants, didn't need their coal power plants. So those people are doing it. Why shouldn't we?
Well, again, I think what Ozzy is saying, and there's some truth to this, is that the building of renewable energy systems does take today energy that includes fossil energy. And the scale of what needs to be built to replace our fossil energy systems is huge. It really is. So when you take today's numbers of how much fossil energy is used to build a solar panel or a wind turbine, and you map that into the total number needed without doing anything else. You just take a simplistic approach. Then you realize that's a lot of emissions. Now, I would still argue that's a better use of the emissions than burning it without getting any renewable energy out of it. But even if it's true, well, I mean, it's not true when you look into the future. You say, well, look, wait a second. I'm not going to be building solar panels and wind turbines using fossil energy in the future. I'm going to be using renewable energy. So his calculations are wrong, and I also think his premise, even starting today, that the amount of fossil energy needed to make a solar panel, I think is just wrong. I think he's using outdated numbers, or there's lots of different studies, and you could cherry-pick the worst-case ones.
Yes, we talked to Mark Jacobson from Stanford, and he had brought out an article in 2009 outlining how the world could switch to renewable energy. It was published in Scientific American, and when we talked to him about a month ago, he said, well, it takes maybe 6 months to get your power back in a solar panel purchase. Depending on where you live, it could take a year if you're in New England or 6 months if you're in Arizona. So the numbers have come down already from what Ozzie Zehner was talking about.
Yeah. And by the way, so the other problem I have with what Ozzie says is someone at the end of his Google talk, someone asked him, well, okay, if you were a dictator of the world, what would you do? And he said, I would have universal health care. And I would change zoning laws to allow higher urban density so you could have people living closer to mass transportation. I mean, that's not a person who's serious about addressing the climate change challenge ahead of us. We don't have a lot of time left. Our emissions are accelerating upwards. While those two things, healthcare and urban density, are, if you did them right, would help contribute to the solution, certainly not in any time frame that's going to have us avoid these terrible impacts from climate change. So we need to act now. We need policies that start reducing emissions immediately. And again, the good news is that there are policies, as I mentioned, the fee and dividend, putting the price on carbon and giving the money back to everyone will actually immediately begin reducing emissions. It will stimulate investment in clean energy technologies, the kind of stuff I do, and will greatly increase deployment of renewable energy systems. And we'll do that all by creating millions of jobs at the same time. You know, that's a much more effective policy than just these kind of indirect things that Ozzie was suggesting. So I don't know, it's really kind of hard to tell where he's coming from. It's hard to tell whether he takes global warming seriously or not, or whether he's just saying, well, we might as well just party from now on because there's nothing you can do about it. It seems to be more of his attitude. I don't believe that.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Well, there are people who believe that we're doomed anyway, so you might as well enjoy what's left of your life. I'm not in that camp. I think that we are in a difficult situation, which looks like it's going to get worse, but we can prevent it from heading to the very worst if we get going. Do you have any sort of time frame, Dan Miller, where you think we really must act, and if we don't, then it's really too late?
Well, first of all, I do agree with you that, first of all, climate change is already happening. We're already having negative impacts, so obviously it's impossible to avoid the impacts of climate change are happening already. And I also agree that if we do take aggressive action, it's still going to get worse, because I guess the number one thing when I give talks on climate change, I think the number one thing that's surprising to people is that everyone views climate change as an environmental problem, right? But all the other environmental problems we know, they get better when you finally address them. So if you have a polluted river and there's a factory polluting it, finally when you get the political will to get the factory shut down, then the river cleans up and you can go fishing and swimming again. Same thing for polluted air, even in China. If they shut down the coal plants, the air will get cleaner. But CO2 is not like that kind of pollution. It's different. It lasts in the atmosphere for hundreds to thousands of years. So when you stop polluting, emitting CO2, things just stop getting worse. They don't get better. So we're on a trajectory to keep emitting CO2, even if we start to reduce it. So things are going to get worse. But as you point out, there's worse, and then there's far, far worse. So getting back to your question, I think we need to get on a very urgent and dramatic trajectory for reducing emissions sometime this decade and start it, and then be very aggressive in the following decades. And that will probably still hit around 2 degrees, and that will not be, no one will be happy with that. but it will be far, far better than going to the 4 degrees that we're on track for the end of the century. And as someone mentioned, I can't remember who it was, they said the difference between 2 degrees warming and 4 degrees warming is human civilization. So, you know, whether that's right or not, I don't know, but it's certainly something to give us pause and get us going on the right track.
Well, now you're working with the Rota Group. You actually founded it, I guess, the venture capital group. Do you find that you can find people in the investing world and in the stock world who are taking climate seriously?
First of all, I would say that there's not enough people, at least in our field of venture capital, that are focusing on clean technology. Everybody wants to get some quick turn on a social networking company or something like that. They don't take a lot of investment, and they have very big payouts when they're successful. But I do think the world is becoming paying more and more attention, and there are more and more people, not only in venture capital, but in sort of the mainstream financial markets, that are starting to pay attention. You're starting to hear about stranded assets for the fossil fuel industry and the whole divestment campaign, for example. I mean, those kinds of things haven't had a big impact yet, but they are changing the way people are thinking and talking in financial circles. To answer your question, I think it is changing. It hasn't changed enough, but I think that's starting to move in the right direction.
What about this crash in the price of oil? I think it could be a temporary thing. By temporary, it could be a couple of years, but it's going to go back up again because people are going to want oil, and it's going to cost even more money to get it out now that people are dumping some of their investments. Bloomberg's writing up to $1 trillion worth of money that would have been spent going looking for more fossil fuels won't be spent. Of course, that's good from a climate point of view. Maybe that breathing space of endless looking for more fossil fuels will give us a chance to look at what else we could be investing in.
Well, I think the low price will, eventually, if nothing else happens, that will encourage people to get SUVs and to do other things where they're not as efficient. I think one of the biggest problems of a low price on oil is that it offsets the use of renewable energy deployments. In other words, there's a lot of companies working on next generation biofuels and things like that. And having a low price on oil makes it hard for those companies to compete. Because, again, it's a sort of unfair playing field to begin with. The fossil fuels get to pollute the atmosphere for free, and the renewable energy systems aren't polluting, but they don't get any credit for that, right? So it's unfair to start with. And then with a low price on oil, that makes it even harder. But I think the good news is that the low price on oil makes it an ideal time to put a carbon fee into place. Because, you know, the price is already low, the price will be below what it used to be anyway. And as you ratchet up the price over time, it will give people more and more incentive to switch to renewables, to use more energy efficiency and get a fuel-efficient car and all these other kinds of things. So I think we have to, you know, there's some good and bad to come out of a low price on oil. I think if we can use the low price to get a carbon policy in place quickly, then it will be a great thing.
All right, so let's try and wrap this up. What do we say about Aussie Zahner? Are we deluding ourselves as Greens when we're hoping for solar or wind power, or should we just keep on pushing and hope that the technology catches up to our ideals for it?
Well, I think, first of all, I think he's just plain wrong in some of the numbers he's using, as you mentioned, and I alluded to as well, that his numbers on solar panels, you know, being as bad as fossil fuels, just plain wrong. I mean, I don't know what else to say about that. But also, I think his general assumption that these renewable energy systems will continue to use fossil fuels for their manufacture is also wrong. Obviously, as you build enough renewable energy sources, you'll use it for making new renewable energy systems. And bottom line is, on the fossil fuel emissions path we're on, we're really in a lot of trouble. He doesn't seem to talk about that, by the way. He kind of alludes to it, but I don't think he fully understands what that all means. So we have a choice before us, and one of the choices is to use some of our fossil fuel emissions now for building renewable energy systems and getting on to a low-carbon future. And we either do that or we don't. It seems pretty clear to me that doing that is a good thing. And he's just sort of being like a gadfly, I guess, you know, just like complaining, looking at the downside of any positive thing we might do. That doesn't mean that solar panels don't use some toxic materials. It also doesn't mean we can't address that issue by maybe using new materials for making them, for example. But yes, there are some downsides to anything we do. The thing is to be intelligent about looking at the issue and seeing what the path forward is. I think he's being very simplistic and again, using some wrong numbers to start with, actually. He's not providing any solution. So he's not really, he's just complaining without providing the solution.
Good enough. So do you have contact information that you'd like to give out, a website or Facebook page, so people can follow up on what you're doing, Dan Miller?
Yeah, I have a website for sort of my climate outreach activities, and it has, for example, the TEDx talk I gave there is on the homepage. I have briefing for policymakers and then lots of links, so if people want to get smarter about climate change, list the books they can read, all that kind of stuff. It's called climateplace.org, climateplace.org, and they can actually, there's a way they can contact me through that as well if they go to the contact page on that site. So climateplace.org.
I appreciate your sharing your time with us. Dan Miller is the managing director of the Rota Group, a Berkeley venture capital group that he co-founded, and it's focused on clean tech. And as we've talked about, he's involved in all sorts of things like grabbing carbon from the air and better batteries. So some of the answers are going to come from the kind of things that he finds seed money for. Dan Miller, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
Before I begin to counter some of Ozzie Zehner's positions on alternative energy, I want to outline the many ways I agree with Zehner. I appreciate his courage in speaking unpopular thoughts. I can't emphasize this enough. Ozzie Zehner, in his book Green Illusions and in his talks, raises fundamental issues about our direction into the future. Don't miss any opportunity to learn from him. For example, Zehner says alternative energy cannot power the wasteful civilization we have now. Not without killing off the planet. I agree totally. A society powered by alternative energy will have to use a lot less power, and should, to preserve what is left of nature. There are many ways this can happen, too many ways to list them all here. In short, we could stop making things that don't last, stop buying things we don't need, and make sure our purchases are the least ecologically and socially harmful possible. Those require a major change in lifestyles in developed countries and changes in aspirations in less developed nations. We can also get a lot smarter personally or through computer-mediated power management. We can demand passive house or net zero standards for all new construction. We can dump all the glass models for apartments and skyscraper office buildings. The list goes on, and Ozzie supports these kinds of energy changes. Green energy will not power the wasteful system we have now. He's right. In a coming Radio EcoShock show, I plan to run an in-depth conversation about that from the Post Carbon Institute. Meanwhile, Zehner is correct about trying to fill the leaky bucket we have now. He says, we don't have an energy crisis, we have a consumption crisis. That's correct. There's also a lot of truth that the promise of green energy has paradoxically encouraged some people to carry on with deadly amounts of energy use. The drive for a technical fix is very strong. It's true, just pasting a few solar panels on a complete energy hog of a building is window dressing. It's also true that we might well wreck the earth if we engage in a binge of making and installing alternative energy to keep the status quo. We may create a burst of new carbon in a mass plan to change over from fossil fuel plants to solar and wind energy and geothermal and all the other forms like hydro. However, as Mark Jacobson from Stanford just told us, new carbon can be offset by cleaner production anywhere from 6 months to a year later. Then there's a long period with solar of up to 25 years or more when carbon would be greatly reduced from the alternative of not building that green energy. Now, I do object when Ozzie Zehner uses emotional triggers which are not based on science. He compares solar power, for example, to a religion. Some of his heated words are not the language of science but might be at home on Fox News. I feel he communicates a personal grudge which remains unexplained so far. Let's start with electric vehicles. He says,
but the National Academy of Sciences did a study, a life cycle analysis. It's the broadest life cycle analysis done on electric cars. And they found that the harms stemming from electric cars are a little bit larger than the harms stemming from a regular internal combustion engine of a car the same size. In fact, the only way that we can really find that electric cars are cleaner is if we narrow our research to just one metric, like CO2.
Well, first of all, this one narrow metric of carbon dioxide is actually the largest threat to humans and all species in millions of years. Building carbon dioxide threatens us with great harm and possibly extinction. This is a completely different metric than possible increased cancers from improperly storing toxic waste from batteries or solar panels. Carbon dioxide is the really big deal. Reducing it is a bonus strong enough on its own to justify electric cars. Aussie doesn't tell us about the scale of threats. The paper he refers to was published by the National Academies Press. It is Hidden Costs of Energy, Unpriced Consequences of Energy Production and Use. The book represents the work of many scientists and was issued by a committee of the National Research Council in 2010. You can find out more about Aussie's objections to electric vehicles in his feature article in the publication Spectrum. That was published June 20th, 2013. The title is Unclean at Any Speed. I'll put a link to that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. The conclusions of the 2010 paper that Aussie cites are directly contradicted by more recent research in two papers published in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, or PNAS. The first is Valuation of Plug-in Vehicle Life Cycle Air Emissions and Oil Displacement Benefits by Jeremy J. Machaleka et al. The study does not support the radical statements that Zahner makes in his talk. The most recent study was published by scientists in PNAS this November 2014, about 2 years after Aussie's speech, so he wouldn't have seen it when he made that speech. It's titled Life Cycle Air Quality Impacts of Conventional and Alternative Light-Duty Transportation in the United States. It's by Christopher W. Tasuma et al. The paper summarizes the situation as follows, quote, "We find that powering vehicles with corn ethanol or with coal-based grid-average electricity increases monetized environmental health impacts by 80% or more relative to using conventional gasoline. Conversely, EVs powered by low-emitting electricity from natural gas, wind, water, or solar power reduce environmental health impacts by 50% or more. Consideration of potential climate change impacts, alongside the human health outcomes described here, further reinforces the environmental preferability of EVs powered by low-emitting electricity relative to gasoline vehicles. So sure, if you run electric cars on biofuels made of corn or on coal, you make the environment worse. There's no surprise there. But electric vehicles can easily use clean sources, and they can transfer over to those sources, unlike gas vehicles. So far, most electric vehicles have been sold in California, which uses very, very little corn ethanol or coal. Aussie told his audience electric vehicles run on bull manure, according to the National Academies. New science shows they can be a much better choice, not only for the climate, but for public health. Sorry, Aussie. My next major objection to Aussie's presentation is when he says alternative energy cannot replace itself. As we heard from Dan Miller, there are already solar manufacturing facilities run on solar power. Aussie says,
"The problem is that certain types of industries rely on certain types of energy, so it's difficult to explore for copper and bring the trucks out there if they're only running on electricity."
So I looked into that. My research finds that mining companies, particularly in South Africa, are beginning to power their intensive milling operations with alternative energy. Certainly they can do it with hydropower or nuclear power, which existing mines already use. Electricity is electricity, and that's what mines use most. Surely we can't run the big trucks on anything but fossil fuels? Nonsense. Electric vehicles can be stronger, with more torque, that means more real working power than any diesel engine. An all-electric mine is completely possible. Again, as we often see in his work, it seems to me that Aussie's vision is limited by what exists today, the old fossil industrial model. That's the way it is, so that's the only way it could be, Zahner tries to tell us, reinforcing our stereotypes. Now look, German heavy industry has run entirely fossil-free on some days this past year, including from the production of wind generators. Iceland runs entirely on renewable geothermal energy, including its energy-intensive aluminum industry. Next up, Aussie Zahner spends much time in his talk explaining that solar power is a threat to our forests. This argument against deforestation by solar power, well, it's ludicrous. Aussie found a few instances where solar panels were installed by cutting down trees. In the global picture of deforestation, the pinprick caused by solar deforestation is so small it could not be seen. We should also remember the deforestation caused by tar sands mining, creating roads for fracking rigs, and mountaintop coal mining. He doesn't mention those or compare them. The argument is a straw man, in my opinion. Similarly, the fact that some maintenance is needed for solar power in a desert setting is also a straw man argument. First of all, a study done by an oil-producing state like the United Arab Emirates is immediately suspect. They are evaluating a product that could wipe out their profits and possibly their economy. Secondly, what other source of energy runs with so few employees compared to solar or wind? Coal-fired, gas-fired, oil-fired electric plants all need employees too, and regular maintenance. These power stations occasionally explode, which solar does not. Oil and coal plants also kill people locally and even at great distances with their pollution. Solar operators might have to clean dust off their solar panels. So what? I wonder why Aussie works so hard to catalog minor to very minor aspects of alternative energy. And why doesn't he give us comparable figures from fossil fuel plants?
But if we were to cover it with solar cells and cover the world's deserts with solar cells, it would destroy civilization as we know it within a single generation, just because of the toxins, the fossil fuels that would be required, the other climate gases that are produced that are many times worse than CO2. If you take that little dot of solar energy that we get currently, or wind power that we get currently, and then multiply those side effects by something like 10,000, that's what you're looking at.
I would love to ask Aussie about his sources or even his reasoning for such a statement. First of all, no one is suggesting, especially Mark Jacobson, that we could or should cover all the world's deserts with solar cells. That's a vast area and not what Jacobson said was needed at all. Nobody is suggesting we cover all the world's deserts with solar panels. The European Union worked through a plan to power most of Europe with a relatively small area of the Sahara Desert alone. So Aussie is arguing with a plan that has never been suggested by anyone that I know of. And the idea that deploying solar fully would kill off civilization in a single generation is wild speculation and the kind of scare statement we could do without.
Radio EcoShock.
He then says, thermal solar has the same side effects, even though it is mainly concrete and glass, not the heavy metals in amounts used in other panels. These thermal solar sites may even use liquid sodium as batteries instead of lithium. It's a quick statement that Aussie made, and it probably doesn't stand up to scrutiny. He says, what if we multiply solar cells by 100 times, I guess he means the current production, which would incidentally bankrupt the federal government? This is another scare statement. Obviously, if we stopped subsidizing the fossil fuel industries and used a free market system where consumers of energy pays not only for the power but for the carbon pollution, we could multiply solar production by 100 times without bankrupting the federal government. Only a government built on fossil fuel power and fossil industry corruption could go bankrupt by building clean energy. The more fearful listener hears that we cannot proceed with green energy without bankrupting society. Anyway, the U.S. government seems headed for bankruptcy on its own with trillions of dollars in new debts with no help from solar. China will likely increase its solar power by 100 times what it had in 1990, but I doubt the government will collapse because of that. It's a strange claim and an extreme one that does not help his argument. Why does Aussie Zehner pick up on solar energy so much as his main thrust against green energy? We'll grant him the time limitations in his talk. He can't cover everything. But still, wind energy has become the major source of power for countries like Denmark and provides a lot of juice for Germany. We don't hear about geothermal energy, maybe due to time limitations, but it powers Iceland and can do more in many countries, including Australia and the United States. Then there's hydropower and nuclear power. I agree that nuclear is too dangerous to use, but it's there now. The point is, we don't get a picture of solar energy as part of a large alternative energy mix, doing what it does best where it can. Instead, we are brought to fear the expansion of some allegedly toxic giant. Zehner doesn't offer us a balance between using alternative energy with its known risks versus not using it with the gigantic risk of mass extinction, including ourselves, from carbon pollution of the atmosphere. As Dan Miller says, he doesn't really seem to get the big risks of climate change. Assuming we have to choose between better health care, available already in almost every other developed country, and alternative energy, that's a false choice. We can do both. We will continue to use energy. It may as well be less harmful energy. Climate change threatens to wipe out not only our health, but our food and our water sources in many cases. Zehner says there's no proof that adding alternative energy actually decreases the use of fossil fuels. That's the Jevons paradox, which he doesn't cite directly. He calls it the boomerang effect, and it has been true. It's a big worry. But the past is not necessarily an image of the future. For various reasons, the United States has decreased its emissions and its use of fossil fuels. Germany has greatly reduced their fossil fuel emissions, not only through the addition of solar and wind power, but also through better building techniques, mass transit, more energy awareness, and so on. To say adding a cleaner energy source will just add to the waste and make things worse is demonstrably wrong already in some countries and will become increasingly wrong as more alternative energy is added to the mix. Zahner says solar panels have the illusion of a price drop, which are really based on subsidies, but he fails to provide the comparative assessment of massive subsidies to solar competitors like oil and gas and coal. These fossil fuels get direct subsidies and tax breaks of many billions of dollars every year from governments for decades while they built their empires. They get free dumping of carbon dioxide into the air and do not pay for the health costs of their pollution. The whole highway system is built for their products. The subsidies to fossil fuels are almost beyond calculation and make tiny the subsidies to solar and wind. It's a laughable argument. His claim that solar panels tend to age and parts like regulators have to be replaced is specious. Anyone who runs a fossil-powered car knows they fall apart. They need maintenance, ditto power plants of any kind. How do the costs of solar power compare to fossil power? That's what we need to know. And that Aussie doesn't provide. That's a disservice, warning us away from a source of power that may in fact be cheaper to maintain, but he doesn't tell us that. Again, in the so tiny it doesn't matter category of those reasons not to install solar, the panels might be stolen. All right, what are the figures for stolen solar in the United States? He doesn't say. Your car is far more likely to be stolen, so you won't ever buy a car? Would you buy that argument? He's also found some solar panels not facing the sun. What percentage of solar installations is that? 0.0001%, I would guess, or less? Why look for human foibles to argue against a much cleaner technology which might prevent the climate catastrophe? It's almost like a shopping list of pointless objections, I think. In his talk, Aussie Zahner claims even some of the most expensive options for dealing with CO2 would become cost competitive long before today's solar technologies. Really? First of all, I'm not aware of any viable technology for reliably removing and storing CO2 other than not producing it, as solar does. So he's comparing a technology that does not exist with one that does. Second, I haven't seen any such paper, nor are we likely to. I think it's an example of the extreme statements that Zahner makes in the long reach to make his case. While it may be true that the current manufacturing techniques for solar panels involves the release of greenhouse gases thousands of times more powerful than CO2, that is true. Zahner doesn't give us a comparison between these billion parts per million emissions with the masses of tons of CO2 averted by the use of solar. It's just the tip of an iceberg of facts that he gives us, and studies, we need lots more of them to evaluate this claim. Zahner tells his audience there's no evidence that alternative energy offsets fossil fuel use in the United States. First of all, why limit the statement to the United States, which is the world model for energy prolificacy? The U.S. is more or less the last of the developed nations to deploy alternative energy on a scale that matters. America has avoided the infrastructure like mass transit, high-speed rail, and other techniques which can match up well with alternative energy to reduce fossil fuel dependence. It's a misleading statement implying that alternative energy cannot reduce fossil fuel use, which is a wrong-headed approach. Aussie says, most importantly, alternative energy financing relies ultimately on the kind of economic growth that fossil fuels provide. This is an intriguing argument, and it has a lot of truth to it. However, as discussed already, continuing to find and provide fossil fuels also relies on growth. The growth model may be breaking, which threatens all energy sources, not just solar. Plus, once installed, solar does not require the continued production and importation of fuel. It may in fact be a better answer to the problem of needing continual growth. In any case, it is the large economic system of growth that is unsustainable, not the power system feeding it. If we disinvest from things like the tar sands and Arctic drilling, not to mention the military, we could create much more alternative energy, even without growth. Zahner repeatedly maligns people who want solar power as being religious or worshipping solar cells and setting up temples to them. Then he says we make a fetish out of solar cells using a negative image from psychology. Let's stop the vilification of people trying to find solutions to climate change. Zahner frankly fails to offer good solutions himself. Sorry, his solutions of better healthcare and densification of cities will take decades, and we don't have that long. Ozzy replies to a question about Mark Jacobson's research by saying, if you ask a ridiculous question, you can find a ridiculous answer. Is it ridiculous to ask if we can find enough power using alternative energy sources? I don't think so. Listen to my recent Radio EcoShock interview with Mark Jacobson. Ozzy says Jacobson hasn't asked meaningful questions. In fact, Ozzy's answer is very weak and dismissive of the work of a major scientist who has published over 100 valuable scientific papers. Jacobson at Stanford is far above Ozzy's pay grade. One of his questioners asks if there's any example from history of conserving our way out of a crisis. That is the crux of Zaner's argument, but he has no such examples. He might have given the Soviet Union, I suppose, after their collapse, or Cuba after the 1990 loss of oil, but he did not. Well, I've run out of time before I could go into the many more ways that I do agree with Ozzy Zaner. He's dead on about our addiction to technical solutions and our harmful consumer lifestyles. We have a tendency to damage nature with our best intentions. I like Ozzy Zaner and his work. He serves as a valuable caution on how we can do alternative energy the wrong way and damage a lot of things in the process. But I think his main venture is a disservice to the future. We need solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, and all sorts of non-carbon energy. We need them quickly. Clean energy is less energy, says Ozzy Zaner. Yes, that's true, but clean energy is not a situation of no energy. We will continue to use energy, and getting it from the Canadian tar sands or the Arctic deepwater drilling will fill the atmosphere with carbon and kill us. We need to use the greenest tech to produce the minimum energy we need. Now, fortunately, Ozzy Zaner cannot stop solar energy or any green technology. I'm told 1 out of 4 homes in Australia has solar panels on the roof right now. European countries are decarbonizing rapidly. The nations that listen to Ozzy and his stalling new forms of climate-friendly power will be the last in the economic competition. America needs to catch up quickly or be stuck in the left-behind old coal age. At the end, Ozzy Zaner calls for, quote, a green movement that is not simply a receptacle for energy firms and car companies to plug into. A green movement that looks beyond the eco-gadgets on the stage to consider the social and environmental justices behind the curtain. I applaud this. I applaud Ozzy Zaner for demanding we move into the future with our eyes open, always asking questions. I'm Alex Smith. Find all our past Radio EcoShock programs free at the website, ecoshock.org. Find links to pretty well everything we've discussed in this show in my weekly blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.